This podcast is brought to you by the North Star, an independent media company fully supported by our members at thenorthstar.com. We are able to speak truth to power without fear or hesitation because people just like you support this work with their monthly and annual contributions. If you're already a member, thank you. If not, join us so that we can continue our liberation journalism through podcasts, articles, activism, and so much more. Again, join us now at thenorthstar.com.
This is Ray King.
And this is Sean King.
And we are
Married to the Movement.
So this is Ray and Sean King, back with Married to the Movement. And in today's episode, we're going to spend some time talking about the genesis of the Black Lives Matter movement in our household, and, you know, how we came to learn about it, be involved with it, and, you know, kind of like its early effects on our family and our married life. And so just want to tell that story a little bit. Sean has not always been at Sean King. Again, that's what I call
him. I was born at Sean King.
Okay, right. That's what I call his persona. Like, oh, okay, you're being real at Sean King right now. But, you know, he was just Sean yep. In a number of different ways, whatever. We were Ray and Sean. Like, every couple has their identity, right? And, like, you're known as this. You're the this couple or the that couple or whatever. And so I wonder now if a lot of people are just like, oh, you're the, you know, Black Lives Matter, social justice, you know, couple or whatever. Maybe not couple. I don't think people think of me in that way.
I think people may, you know, now when we're out and about in public and people see you, they recognize you. If they see us together, they definitely recognize the two of us together and people, you know.
Yeah, that's been so interesting because for most of these last 6 years or so, you know, I could move throughout the world with a real level of anonymity. Like, right. I've always said, I look like every Black girl. Like, there's just no, I don't have any, like, discerning features, you know. It's not like, oh, she's got the red hair or, like, I just look like, you know, just regular people walking around.
I think you're hot. You know, that's, I just want to put that in there.
Well, okay, that's because every Black girl is hot. So if I look like every Black girl, right. There you go. But no, I mean, just like nothing that really stood out. And sure. So I could blend in.
But that was also because we made a decision, and we'll talk about these decisions that we made almost 6 years ago. It's like, hey, let's keep the kids off of social media so that you could have some level of anonymity.
Right, yeah. I mean, plus, I think, heck, my social media accounts have been private maybe, like, always.
Yeah,
you know, I've always
years.
Just been, like, a really, you know, private person that you know, had my circle and was fine with that. And it's really just been in the last, I would say, year or so that has gotten to the point where when I'm by myself, like me and the kids, we always knew that if we were out and about with you, we were going to get stopped a certain number of times. But if it was just me or just me and the kids by ourselves, you know, we were just going to be just like everybody else and nobody was ever going to stop us. And I would say it's really been in the last year or so that has changed. And it still shocks me every single time I'm on the subway or shopping at a mall and somebody will stop me and be like, hey, are you married to or are you? And I'm like, really? Like, really? Yeah. It still surprises me to be recognized in that way because I don't think most people go through their life thinking of themselves as anything other than, you know, just the regular person that woke up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do too. I mean, I have to tell people all the time, as much as you, not you, honey, but as much as people in society may look at me and literally think there's at Sean King.
Mm-hmm.
Like I literally hear people whisper that
Oh, yeah.
I'm in public and I hear people, not there's Sean King. I hear people say, there's Sean King.
It's this old it's like, person.
No, this is not Wreck-It Ralph. We are not inside of the video game.
Yeah.
My real name is not at Sean King.
Yeah,
you know?
But that's just not how people know you. You know, that's how they've interacted with you. So that's who you are. And it is. It's like a Matrix kind of situation. Like, this isn't Wreck-It Ralph. We're not inside a video game. But sometimes it does feel like being in the Matrix, you know?
It's tricky because on some days I look at social media and say, this is not real life in the sense that this is not where I eat. It's not where I sleep. It's not where I don't go to the doctor on social media. Like huge aspects of our lives aren't lived on social media.
Right. Like none of it for me. Anyway.
But then on the other hand, you know, there are genuine, passionate ways that we can share about the world, not just issues, but about our lives. And as you now share more of your story publicly on social media, people recognize you. But so far, people have always been nice.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think
publicly, at least.
No, publicly, right. For sure. And I think that's such an interesting, you know, I don't know if metaphor is the right word, but just like, you know, it really goes to show that online world operates under a certain set of rules, anonymity, say it all, at you, whatever, in ways that people never do in real life, you know, and it just really shows you the difference. I remember when you first, like, you've always loved technology, and so, like, you were one of the first people on Twitter. You were one of the first people to be using Facebook and to, like, actually connect to strangers and bring people together. And I remember, I mean, this had to have been, like, 12 years ago, really. I was pregnant with Savannah, and you were, like, making a run out to Whole Foods for me because I had a craving. And
right,
I remember you, like, bringing up out your phone and, like, telling the internet, telling Twitter, but I was like, what are you doing? Like, what is that?
Right.
Who are you talking to?
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then you were like the Facebook pastor, you know, because you were pastoring at the time and using Facebook in these ways. And I remember you would always talk about my friends on Facebook, my friends on this. And I would be like, those people are not your friends. Like, you don't know them. What are you talking about? Well, like, that's not real. And today, it's so interesting to see how 12 years later or so, like, actually there are now people online that I have been Facebook friends with, never met before, but they feel more family, more friend, more connected to me sometimes than some people that I interact with. We're reaching the point now where we've known people for like 10 years on Facebook.
I have an example of that. The founder of the Dream Defenders, the organizer and activist, Philip Agnew. Philip and I, we were at an NAACP event just a few months ago. Philip is now working for Bernie Sanders. But we were at this NAACP event, and Philip and I have texted, talked, Facebooked, DM'd for almost 10 years, all the way, even when Trayvon was murdered, we were messaging with each other during the Black Lives Matter movement.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting down at this NAACP event, and we realized that we had never seen each other face to face.
Oh, wow.
Because we're close, he is my friend, and we have defended each other and supported each other and encouraged each other. And then all of a sudden we realize this is the first time we've ever seen each other face to face. And so technology can close that gap. Like, when we sat down at a table together, we didn't feel like two strangers. We felt like two guys that had known each other for 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's so funny, because even yesterday when I was having breakfast with Opal, you know, and I was like, oh, you know, let's go to the North Star offices. Have you ever met Sean before? She's like, yeah, you know, we met one or two times. And then I came in and asked you, like, hey, you know, when did you meet? You're like, I don't think that we've ever...
Opal can... We're talking about one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter movement. I don't think Opal and I have been in the same room before.
Who knows?
But social media, but we've known each other.
It can make you feel like it. Right, exactly, that you know people. And so, yeah, that's just been a really interesting shift from 12 years ago. And I think that's why we can meet people now. And you are at Sean King. Like, that is a whole, you know, persona and person, and that a lot of people have been connected to even since before your involvement in the Black Lives Matter movement. They saw when, you know, you were, you know, sending tents to Haiti and, you know, uniforms and toys for Stanton Elementary in Atlanta. And so, yeah, like, by the time you have followed someone's journey and interacted and been a part of it for that long, it starts to feel real and like you know people. But anyway, we're digressing. What I really want to spend some time talking about today is just the beginning of this Black Lives Matter movement for our household. Like, a lot of people, and I saw this on my Instagram, didn't know, a couple people didn't know that Black Lives Matter was like an actual organization. So we're not talking about that so much as we're talking about this social public movement centered around police brutality and how that came into our lives.
Hey, my name is Brandon Janice, and I'm the host of Sick Empire, a brand new podcast brought to you by the North Star. On Sick Empire, I interview New Yorkers who, in different ways, fight on the front lines for change in the city during the coronavirus pandemic. Please listen to hear a unique mix of stories from essential workers, small business owners, artists, and elected officials who are all experiencing the chaos of COVID in their own ways. Listen to Sick Empire on all streaming platforms, and you can support the show and any of our other podcasts by heading over to thenorthstar.com and becoming a member.
Sick Empire. Sick Empire.
I've always cared about issues of injustice. And when I was a student at Morehouse, we fought back against the police brutality against Amadou Diallo. Years after that, we had already had kids. And I remembered it was the early days of social media posting about other incidents of police brutality, of mass incarceration. And some people don't realize that I worked in jails and prisons for several years as a traveling teacher and speaker. I did that full time in Atlanta for several years, which gave me a real inside look and heart for issues related to mass incarceration.
Isn't it interesting to like look back and see all the steps and the events in your life that kind of built up and led to a particular thing that, you know, you might be doing now? Like, we weren't thinking about that when you were going to youth detention centers and, you know, doing all that, but it all just really,
it all came together.
It works together, right?
And then, you know, from 2007, really all the way to 2014, which some people think of the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement as 2013 with the death of Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But from 2008 until 2013 and 2014, technology and social media was a huge part of my life. And so I was regularly trying to share stories, not just about injustice, but about human need, about natural disasters, I was always trying to figure out how can we use social media to help people in some kind of way. And I tried to use that to share the story about Trayvon Martin in 2013, but it was in 2014, we had just moved to California, and I had just taken a job at this environmental charity. And,
we had lived in California. We hadn't just moved there. I think we had just gotten back from our stay in South Africa.
That's right. But we had just moved into a new place.
Yeah.
Because we basically, you know, closed down the place where we were living, put all of our stuff in storage, and then lived in South Africa for a big chunk of 2014.
Yeah. Well,
And then moved back. And we moved back that summer, I think.
Yeah, we moved back that summer. It's so crazy looking back, thinking like we literally just were like, hey, the lease is up on this house. you had written your, or you were writing your first book, or and had just gotten like a
book advance.
Yeah, a book advance. And we were just like, and I was homeschooling the kids. And so, you know, I didn't have an outside job and the kids weren't tethered to a school. And so we literally just said, let's pick a place in the world to go and live while you write this book. And so, like, it's so funny back then, like, we weren't young. Like, we were in our, early 30s, I think.
Yeah.
But just
early to mid 30s.
Yeah, like, what were we doing? Like, we just did it. We didn't have any plans. So then we got back from
South. The moment had a profound impact on the whole family.
Oh, 100%. It's one of my favorite thing that we've ever done. But I'm just saying, living that spontaneously, like, here we are now. Closer to 40, you're all the way at 40.
Yeah, I'm not close to 40.
Yeah,
I'm
there.
I'm damn close to 40. I'm so close. Right, yeah, I am 40.
Yeah, right. You are 40, right. But I still got a little ways to go. Yeah. But, like, we would never make that kind of decision now. Like,
right.
One, we don't have the freedom to. But when we got back here, we didn't have a plan. Like, I didn't have a job. You didn't have a job. I don't know what
crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what we thought we were going to do.
When we moved back to California, you got hired. We were living deep in Orange County, but you got hired as a teacher in South Central Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I took a job at this environmental charity. It wasn't even a job I really wanted.
No, it was just a job like
it was
that
just a
you
job,
needed.
Job.
Like, we had spent a couple months over the summer. I think we were living on, like, the last of your book advance.
Right.
And then we were working hard. I worked really hard to get certified to teach in California. I looked really hard for a job and was just, like, so thankful when this one. I remember when I did the interview for it, I was, like, in the parking lot of, like, the local Chili's. You guys were inside. And I, like, went outside to take this phone call.
Yeah.
Like, we both just desperately needed jobs. And so, yeah, I started teaching at the charter school, and then you...
I took this job. I was the communications director for Global Green, and this was in their national office, which was in Santa Monica, just like a block from the beach. And, many of our listeners have this type of job now. It wasn't a job that I really loved. It wasn't a job I was super passionate about. But it was a job that paid the bills.
Right.
And that's the job most people have.
Yeah.
And so I was glad I had it. And I was glad that it was still kind of in the social good space. I was mainly writing press releases. I was writing mass emails. I was doing a lot
about environmental justice. Not even environmental justice.
Wasn't about,
yeah.
This was before this modern movement of environmentalism about the climate crisis. People were hardly talking even about environmental justice. This was a very white, ultra-liberal, mainstream organization that was mainly talking about global warming on the most basic level.
Oh, okay.
And most of my work there was not even the slightest bit woke. I was mainly... The organization had this annual Oscars gala that they did with Vanity Fair every year, and that gala was their biggest fundraiser of the year every single year. So most of my work was about press releases for people who had committed to be at the gala. It wasn't even about the environment. Most
that
of what
is
I was
so
doing.
Wild. Like, I can't even picture you doing that. You know, like, it's so interesting. Because, like, when you say 5 or 6 years, it's not that long ago,
right?
But it's a whole-ass lifetime for us right now.
Right, I'm writing, like, a press release, excited that Michelle Pfeiffer is going to be at the Vanity Fair Global Green Gala.
That is so wild.
Which, it was not a normal job for me.
No, it was so different than anything you had ever done. And first of all, you've lived 9 lives, right? Like, you've done, so you're like Forrest Gump, right? Like,
yes.
All the different jobs that you've had. And let's just lay it out on the table. Like, you were never a good worker. Like, not that you didn't work hard, but
I worked my ass off.
Like, you worked hard, but you got fired, basically.
What?
Yeah,
what are you talking
about? True. From every, because because you were just never, and looking back on it now, I totally understand. Like, you were never going to be that guy that could clock in, clock out, sit at a desk, send out random press releases about things you don't care about. You know what I'm saying? Like, you were most in your element when you were working at youth detention centers and, you know, even pastoring to a certain extent. Yeah. But you've always been like a really restless soul, which I think is really interesting, because when this movement came about as it did in such a public way, I feel like it's really one of the first times where you have been able to connect these passions that have been building and growing and that you've been honing in different ways over your life into kind of like this culminating time.
You know, when we were college students at Morehouse and Spelman, and people would say to me like, hey, I think you're going to be this generation's Malcolm X, or you're going to be this generation's Martin Luther King.
Who was saying that?
Well, I mean, these are the things people would say on campus. Like, this is we expect you to be a civil rights leader. And but we had a family so quick. We had a family while we were still in college.
Yeah.
That right out of college, we were just working full time and raising kids and building our family. And so when I took this job at Global Green, I was blown in the wind a little bit as far as jobs were concerned.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
It was in July. Just your birthday is on July 16th, and this was maybe a day or two after your birthday in July of 2014. I got a Facebook. I was at my office at Global Green, and I got a Facebook message from a buddy of mine that I went to Morehouse with, actually, who lived, we're recording this in New York, and my buddy of mine was from New York. And he told me that somebody had just sent him a YouTube video of a case of police brutality.
Mm.
And he sent me the link in the Facebook message. And he described, I didn't click on the link yet, but he described what was in the video. And he said, Sean, there's a horrible video on YouTube. We didn't know the man's name yet. And he said it's of a huge middle-aged black man who's being harassed by police. And he said, Sean, the guy's begging the police to leave him alone, saying he didn't do anything. And he says, Sean, all of a sudden, a police officer comes up behind the man and puts him in, my friend said, in like a UFC-style chokehold, like a mixed martial arts chokehold. And he says, Sean, the officer wrestles the man to the ground, continues to choke him. And he said, you could hear the guy yell out that he couldn't breathe. And he told me right in the message, he said, the guy dies right there on the sidewalk. And I'm at my cubicle, and I'm reading this. Now, you have to go back in time with me, because now, in 2019, we've seen and heard dozens of videos like this. But in July of 2014, there had never been a viral video of someone being killed by police. That was not yet a thing. So when my homie sends me a message saying, hey, man, there's a video on Facebook of somebody getting killed.
Up to that point, you know, you heard about it. You heard what happened. You heard about Sean Bell and Amadou Diallo.
Even other instances of racial violence. Like, we heard about what happened to Trayvon Martin. We heard about these cases, and I think only
the Rodney King case really comes to mind.
You got to go all the way back to 1992, and even then, you know, Rodney King didn't die as a result of it.
Yeah.
So I had never seen anything like that, and there had never been anything like that posted of someone being killed by police. And I had this weird moment where I didn't know if I should click on the video in front or around my coworkers.
Mm.
Like, I just didn't know what the people in my office would think when they heard it or saw it. So I remember literally kind of waiting until people scurried off for lunch, and I clicked on the link. And it was the man that we later came to know as Eric Garner. And it was just as my friend described. But I say this in my book. I feel guilty about it now. But there was a moment where I thought my friend must have left some details out. Because my friend my friend just said, man, Eric Garner, this man, he didn't say Eric Garner, he said, this man is just asking the police to leave him alone. And all of a sudden, an officer comes up behind him and chokes him to death.
I think that was still a time, particularly like if you didn't grow up you know, in places where you had frequent interactions with the police and you were really like, you know, immersed in that, and you understood right. what those interactions looked like, felt like, you understood police culture. Like, if you're just a regular person really far removed from that, it is still unbelievable to think that somebody could literally just be minding their business
right.
and doing this small thing
right.
and that leads to their death. It does seem incomprehensible, and so it makes sense to think, well, what else happened? Like, there must
That's
be something else
thought,
to this story.
When my friend described it, I was watching the video just waiting to see what he had left out. And I immediately realized that it was just as my friend described, but way worse. And that Eric Garner did nothing. He never laid his hands on anybody, never threatened anybody, and never would have. And I remember literally watching him die. The whole video wasn't 15 seconds. The whole video was like 11 minutes. And I watched this man die, and I watched police officers and other people poke around on him. I watched one officer basically act like Eric was pretending. He had died already.
Oh, my God.
And they were trying to figure out, like, why he was faking like he was asleep or something. It's like, you just killed this man. And even the paramedics were irreverent. Like, they just weren't bothered. And I remember thinking, like,
to this day, I've never seen the full video. I think I've only seen it, like, in bits and pieces,
you know,
as different, you know, news stories or whatever. But I've never watched it.
As you know, I later became good friends with Erica Garner, Eric's daughter, and Erica never watched the video.
I mean,
she
good
never,
Lord. I mean, how could you? I can't imagine.
Well, the whole family had developed. It's, you know, I now know. All of Eric Garner's family, his mother, his wife, all of his children have become friends of mine. And they have all spent these past 5 years chronically, pathologically going out of their way to avoid any contact with that video.
Of course, you don't want to see your loved one like that.
He was a hero in their family. He was a gentle giant to them.
Yeah.
And so they have all avoided it at all costs, which I understand. I was so bothered in that moment. It was a pivotal moment in my whole life. At that moment, it was not big. I didn't know that moment was going to be pivotal, but it was a transitional
moment.
Right,
it's like you say a lot, like you don't really know a moment of time while you're in it.
Yeah. I didn't know that moment was going to be the moment that changed the direction of my life.
Yeah, and it really did. And you know, when you were, it wasn't a moment that I understood, obviously, to be what it was going to be either. And it actually caused a lot of tension in our house because you became so obsessed with this case and the telling of this story and tracking it and, you know, interacting with people online around it and dissecting it. You became so obsessed with it. You were like taking off of work and I was just like, what are you doing? Like, what is this thing? Like, first of all, I wasn't on Twitter. You know, I had not been on Twitter, I think, at that point for maybe a year. I really don't know. But I wasn't on Twitter, wasn't on social media like that. And so when I would come home from this long commute that I had from
hour and a half, 2 hours from South
LA,
Central all the way to Orange County.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd be at home and all I see is you on your computer, right? And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, who are you talking to? Why didn't you go in today? Or are you working? Like, are you making money? Like we had full on arguments about how you were spending your time, because to me, I was just like, what are you doing? Like, it's going to be fine. Like, I don't know what happened, but, you know, like, if it's what you say it is, then, you know, these people are going to be held accountable. Why don't you let the authorities handle it? Who do you think you are? You know, like, all those kinds of things.
You know, a lot of people, now, we hear that now, and that may sound crazy.
Right.
But at the time, and we're talking about just the last few weeks of July and the first week of August of 2014, it was kind of widely believed that the officer who killed Eric Garner was going to be held responsible.
I mean, God, there's a video of him literally choking a man to death.
There was a moment where the former president, Barack Obama was president at the time, but there was this interview with the former president, George W. Bush, who I think had a memoir coming out. And the story of Eric Garner had already taken over the entire country. And they just randomly asked him. It was a CNN interview where they randomly asked George W. Bush if he had seen the video. And George W. Bush, I mean, ultra-conservative Texan, I mean, he said, yeah, he'd seen it and said it was awful. And George W. Bush said something to the effect of, like, he thought it was only a matter of time until somebody was going to be held responsible for it.
Right, right. Because that's what you thought, right?
Conservatives looked at it and thought, yes, somebody's going to be held responsible for this.
Yeah.
And so I basically flipped off a switch for Global Green.
Yeah, you did. And I was, you know, like, practically speaking, like, we are a family, right?
Yeah.
Like, we have kids, we have bills to pay.
Yeah.
California, Southern California is an expensive yep. place to live. You know, we were really trying to get on our feet after this kind of whirlwind, mm-hmm. you know, tour of South Africa. And we had visited some other places.
Right.
And, you know, like, now we're trying to settle in. And I'm like, I need you to make money to help provide for this family because I'm, like, killing myself making this commute every day. And so I was very much focused on the practical aspects of how we are taking care of our family, as most women are, actually,
right.
as most mothers, you know, especially tend to be feet on the ground kind of people. It just looked to me like you were really wasting time. And then also I would say, like, you know, it was also one of the first times where we weren't aligned, you know, on priorities, you know, like when you were pastoring a church and when we were building our family, we were very much aligned on those things.
In agreement. We were a team in agreement with one another. We were, generally speaking, moving in the same direction.
Moving in the same direction, like sharing the same passions, you know what I'm saying? Particularly as it related to you pastoring, because like I said, like we talked about in the previous episode, that was where I thought our lives were. That's always what I thought we were going to do
right.
from the time I was 15 years old and we were dating.
Yeah.
And so that's what felt natural. This other thing that you were starting to get involved in, it just didn't make sense to me.
I think some of the challenge was you were working about 12 to 14 hours a day, if you include the commute.
Yeah.
It was taking you 2 hours to get to the school, 2 hours to get back. And during the 8 hours of your school day as a teacher, you're not checking the news.
Right, exactly. I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand, particularly about elementary school teachers. Like, you get there really early in the morning, 6:30, 7 a.m., especially if you're as obsessed with it as I was.
Sure.
Anytime I'm teaching. You get there super early. You leave late, 4:30, 5 o'clock, you know, later oftentimes. And teachers barely have time to use the restroom.
Literally, holding it for hours
because the day, the pace, like, you're responsible for up to 30 human beings, 6-year-olds, often by yourself.
If you take your eyes off of them, any crazy thing can happen.
Right, absolutely.
Right.
And so you barely have time to use the bathroom. You barely have time to eat lunch. So you're definitely not checking, you know, the news and following, you know, news stories and reading articles. It's like when you're teaching, particularly young children, most of your day is so very isolated to your colleagues and your classroom.
Uh-huh.
And so even if I had known more and really understood, I'm not sure that it would have made so much sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I was just about the practical business of, you know, making sure our family was good.
Well, I remember you saying, you're like, you're gonna get fired.
Oh, absolutely. I was just like, how you be, one, because you always got fired, and so I was just like, we're about to see this all over again.
You know, on the low, I knew that I was putting myself on thin ice with the people at Global Green.
Yeah, because you weren't passionate about that. Like, looking back on it now, it all makes sense, right?
Right.
But at the time, it was just like, you have a job. Like, please do your job and let the people whose job it is to actually take care of this case, let them do their job.
What I saw was that I had an ability to look at what happened to Eric Garner and break down and explain it in a way that everyday people connected with, in a way that the New York Times and the Washington Post, great papers, in a way that they weren't doing, in a way that local news was mainly just telling the story of the police. I was like, you know what? I have to tell the story of this man. I have to tell the story of this victim. And what I started doing right away was just using social media to tell the story from the perspective of the oppressed. And that was something that didn't exist. Like they, you know, now major newspapers have people who are kind of on the social justice beat.
Yeah.
But in July 2014, that didn't exist.
Right.
You might have one person who covered all issues related to race. But you didn't have people who were covering police brutality for their full-time job.
And so when did you, at what point were you writing for Daily Coast? When did that happen?
Well, I tell this story a lot because Global Green probably should have fired me 2 weeks after Eric Garner was killed because...
How long did you work for them?
I worked for them for a total of maybe 3 or 4 months.
Okay.
And so I worked there in June, then in July. The day after Eric Garner was killed, I never did another honest day's work for Global Green again. And I showed up sometimes and did a little bit of work, but I, even when I was in the office, I was mainly trying to organize. I started some groups and started trying to organize people. I started trying to break down these videos and photos. And then in the second weekend in August, we were back home. I still had not been fired from Global Green yet. Global Green understood. People in the office came to understand that I was doing what I was doing. My tweets and Facebook posts and stuff about Eric Garner went super viral. I even in that first week of August, I was on CNN a couple of times. I was on NPR a few times because the way I was breaking down those stories was a way that nobody else was breaking them down. And that second weekend in August, we were home. And I got a text message from a friend of mine that had a link to a live stream video. And so over those past few weeks, millions of people saw me posting about the issues of police brutality.
And which is like so commonplace now, right? Like everyone now or so many people, you know, are using social media as a platform to discuss issues of justice and police brutality and racial injustice and you know. And
to discuss every cause.
To discuss every cause, right? Yeah, but it was very nuanced and you know, an introduction into the mm-hmm. space at the mm-hmm. time when you first started doing it.
And so because people saw me posting so much about Eric Garner, it started almost right away of people telling me any story of police brutality that they saw. And we were at home, and I got this text message from a friend of mine, and it was a live stream video. And he said, Sean, there is a young boy, this is how he described it, who is laying on the middle of a street in a neighborhood called Ferguson, a neighborhood in St. Louis called Ferguson. I never heard of the neighborhood. I'd never heard of Ferguson. And we came to know it's actually like a town inside of St. Louis County. I had never heard of it. And I clicked on the link. This was before Facebook Live. This was before Instagram Live. This was before Periscope. The only way to go live was literally on an app called Livestream. And I clicked on the link and immediately realized I was watching something horrible. It was live and people were crying and screaming in a way that was visceral and emotional. And you could see right there in the middle of the street a boy who had been shot and killed by, we were told, had been shot and killed by police. And there was literally blood flowing down the street. And the people weren't protesters. These were neighbors, cousins, mother, father, grandmother. You know, these were people who knew the boy on the street. And people were deeply emotional and upset. And I remember thinking, here was the thought that I had. It had been about 3 weeks since Eric Garner had been killed. I had the thought, oh my God, police in this country are killing people every 2 to 3 weeks. And this was the first time since Eric Garner had been killed that I heard a story of police brutality. Well, the next day we learned that police in Ohio had shot and killed a young man named John Crawford at a Walmart. And then the next day after that, we learned that police shot and killed a man in Los Angeles named Ezell Ford.
Gosh, it happened like back to back. Back to back. Like that?
What we did not know was that police in this country weren't killing people every 2 to 3 weeks. See, the Washington Post in 2015 won a Pulitzer Prize for creating a database of police violence. What we didn't know in July and August of 2014 is that police were killing at a minimum 3 people a day. And there were some days, there were multiple days in 2014 where police killed 10 people. Not in one place, but all over the country.
Yeah, which is just so crazy to think about. I think that before this time, people like me thought of police brutality in isolated incidents, in Rodney King, in Amadou Diallo, in Sean Bell.
Well, do the math
it seemed
on
like
that.
Something that happened every few years.
Yeah, do the math, because if you do the math on that, Rodney King was assaulted in 1992. If you ask the average American, name the next big case of police violence, they'd have to jump all the way up to 1999 with Amadou Diallo. That's 7 years.
Yeah.
What we didn't know, there's no 7-year gap in police brutality.
Gosh.
What we didn't know, in part because social media didn't exist in 92 or 99. So then you go from 99 to the next.
But there was a little AOL in 99.
Yeah, I mean, there was internet, but not social media in social networks.
Like the viral sense, yeah.
There wasn't Twitter. There wasn't Facebook. There wasn't Instagram. And so then you go from 99 all the way to 2006 when Sean Bell is killed. That's another 7 years.
Yeah.
So you're hearing about national stories of police brutality once every 7 years.
Right, and you think that's how often it's happening.
Nah.
But then, like you said, like now, when Mike Brown was killed and then John Crawford was
Ezell
killed.
Ford.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, this country has lost its mind. But what I think about a lot of times is I think back to, you know, the music that we grew up on and the Ice-T and Ice Cube and all these people who were talking about police brutality. And I didn't connect with it, you know. One, I was young, but two, you know, it was hard to connect with because that wasn't my reality.
If you grew up in Los Angeles, if you grew up in New York, also all of the stories that we heard nationally about police brutality only happened in New York and Los Angeles. What we've since come to understand is that that's not because those are the only places police brutality was happening. It's because those cities had the biggest media outlets.
Mm.
That's where the news came from. The LA Times, the New York Times, NBC, CNN, all of them had major stations there. What we didn't understand, and what I know now, is that police have always been killing people every day.
Right. And now I look back and I think about that music and I think about the fact that they were telling us then what was going on.
Yep.
You know,
it just was not Twitter.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And so in August of 2014, I'm hanging on by a thread at Global Green. And I have to always give them a shout out because they should have fired me right away. But they saw this other work that I was doing and kind of just had grace for it. And they paid me, I think, all the way through the rest of August, even though for the rest of August, all I was doing was trying to tell the stories and organize people around this crisis of police brutality that we later came to understand wasn't every 2 to 3 weeks, not even every 2 to 3 days, but that people were being killed 2 to 3 times a day, every day.
And I remember the Mike Brown case was really, for me personally, like one of the first times where I was like, oh, what the hell?
Oh,
like,
they're killing babies out here.
Oh, now I'm mad, right? Like when Trayvon Martin was killed, I was hurt.
Right.
You know, like it just broke my heart in such that I could barely even engage with it, you know, as a story in the media because it hurt so bad. When Mike Brown was killed, I was like, okay, now I'm mad.
Yeah, just Mike Brown, and you know, I later came to know Mike's mother and father, and Mike had just graduated from summer school, literally just 2 weeks before he was killed. His family was immensely proud. because he didn't get to walk at the regular graduation. And a lot of times when kids don't get to walk, particularly if you come from a community that's struggling sometimes, when you don't get to walk, sometimes kids don't go on back to summer school and finish out. They just move the hell on and get a job. Everybody in Mike's family made sure that he went back to summer school. He got all of his credits. He was the leader of the processional at his summer school graduation. He actually had had a wonderful summer. His father had just gotten married literally 7 days before he was killed. Mike was the best man at his father's wedding. And so Mike Brown had had this wonderful summer, and he was thinking about and preparing to go to a community college there in St. Louis. And all of a sudden, on a random weekend day, he is shot and killed by police there. And as I threw my life into telling these stories and breaking these stories down, I got closer and closer to getting fired by Global Green. And thankfully, a liberal news organization called Daily Coast, at the time I had never heard of.
Mm-mm.
I didn't know Marcos, who founded it. I didn't exist in that political news space.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, a wonderful woman who kind of saved my life at that point, where I didn't know how I was going to continue fighting for justice.
And probably your marriage.
Right. I didn't know how I was going to continue doing what I was doing and pay the bills.
Yeah.
And I didn't apply for this job, but Susan Gardner, who was one of the lead editors at Daily Coast, said, "Sean, everybody here reads your stories every day. We're reading them on Facebook. We're reading them on Twitter." And then she literally said, "A lot of what we write about when we write about police brutality at Daily Coast, we just get from your tweets and Facebook posts. We would love to offer you a job, and all we want you to do is do the same thing you've been doing, writing these posts, describing these cases, but just do it for us and we'll pay you."
Right. And yeah, like get paid to do the thing that you were already doing for free. Right. Like, isn't that, that's the goal, right?
And it saved me, and it gave me an opportunity to say, oh, okay. And she didn't ask me to stop any of the organizing, any of the advocacy. She didn't ask me to take the emotion out of the way I did what I did. She just said, "Listen, we don't want you to change a thing. Just keep on doing it the way you're doing it." And so suddenly, I wasn't just writing tweets and Facebook posts, but I had a platform to write those stories.
Yeah. And you know, what working for the Daily Coast, you know, practically allowed was, like we said, you were already doing this because it was something that you cared deeply about. And, you know, it allowed you to move away from Global Green and you know, draw some kind of a salary and be able to do this work that you cared about. Still, you know, like we're still regular people living our everyday lives. And so it's not like it was never easy street. Like, you know what I'm saying? It was like
even the job at Global Green was hard. Like, I mean, even the job rather at Daily Coast was hard because I was writing 3 or 4 stories a day.
Right.
I remember when they first hired me, I was thinking I was going to write a story a day. Or maybe a story every 2 to 3 days. And they were like, "No, you're going to write 3 a day."
But you were still very much just, I think you became during that time, like just super, you were so immersed. You were really absent, I felt like, mentally from the day to day. You know, there was a large part of our marriage where I felt like, you know, what we did with the kids and everything was much more of a joint kind of effort. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The vacations were planned together. Uh-huh. The school things were done together. Family time, all that kind of stuff. But this, when I look back on it, was a period of your life where there really started to be a major separation between you, or in some ways a separation between what was important to me and our kids and what was important to you and consuming most of your time. And it really
Some of it was a function of my personality such that—
How so?
Well, and that's not to make an excuse for what happened, but some of my personality is when I hone in on a case— of not just when I hone in on a cause,
yeah,
I become so obsessed with it that I am I am apt to drop all types of balls in other areas of my life and then have almost like unintentional, like blinders on where it's all I see. And so as I began advocating for justice for these families who had experienced police brutality and then became somebody that people saw as one of the primary voices to tell these stories, I all of a sudden really started dropping the ball at home, at, you know, just as a present person.
Right. And I think also part of the difference is when you really honed in on a cause before, it was a cause that we could all, you know, be a part of. And so, you know, whether it was the church, if it was the church, it was like there was a place for all of us.
We did it together, right?
Or if it was going to be Hope Mob, the kids were wearing the t-shirts and we were, you know, just like all in it. This was one of the first times where it was like there really wasn't a place for me and the kids in this movement again, because it was so much on social media, which I wasn't a part of.
And not just that, it was also violent and awful.
Exactly, like it was too much emotionally to stay immersed in. And so me and the kids, there was no natural place for us in it. And so it really became your world, like this thing that you did, and you were doing it all the time, around the clock. And we just weren't connected to it in any way. And so those early years of your involvement with, you know, this movement were just very isolating and really, really difficult for our family and our marriage, as I felt like, okay, like, what is this? What are we doing? Like, who are we now? And why do you care so much more about what's going on outside of our house than you care about what's going on inside of our house?
And whether I intended it to feel that way or not, that's how it felt.
Yeah, absolutely.
And while obviously I still loved you and loved the kids, the work really took over my life. And it was even in that moment that I started understanding. I mean, it put a huge strain on our marriage.
Yeah.
And even on my relationship with our kids. It was in that moment that I started understanding why so many civil rights leaders struggle to maintain their marriages.
Yeah, absolutely. And, like it completely makes sense, right? Because, you know, especially then, like they weren't home, you know, traveling a lot. You started, like, all of a sudden you started traveling and being away. And when you traveled before, because you've always been a speaker, and when you traveled before, we were homeschooling. And so it was an adventure. Me and the kids, we'd hop on the plane with you. You'd be working and we'd be exploring whatever city we were in. At this point, our lives had changed. The kids were in school. I was working. We didn't have that freedom and flexibility.
We were very stationary.
Yeah, at this point, even I think we had even moved back to Atlanta.
Yeah, we moved back to Atlanta in 2015.
Yeah.
And we had lived in Atlanta for most of our adult lives. Mm-hmm. Most of the kids were born there.
Yeah.
And so all
left Southern California. One, it was just really expensive. Like, even when you started working and I was working, we just really couldn't afford to be there.
It was that when we were living in Southern California, it was expensive and we had no family there.
Yeah, my mom was living with us, but most of our friends were still in Atlanta. Our family was in Atlanta and Kentucky. And so we decided to move back. But our lives did become much more stationary and much more, you know, kind of normal.
But I definitely came to understand, I mean, even many of my, like, living heroes in the civil rights movement who are around today were divorced sometimes once or twice.
Yeah.
And struggled to maintain their marriages while doing the work. And even the heroes of ours who've been killed, be it Dr. King or Malcolm X, their marriages struggled mightily under the weight of it all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, early on, our marriage struggled because we were just in such different places in terms of our passions and what we were putting our attention on. And I think you look back on it now and admit that you had become distant, aloof, neglectful, all those kinds of things. And so our marriage struggled early on because of those things. Now, I think the stress and the pressure is very different now.
You mean today?
Today, you know, because we're much more aligned, right? Like, I think that you have become more tempered in terms of being and how you spend your time. And then I've come over as well in terms of understanding just the importance of this and have kind of joined in some ways in being a part of the work that you do. And so we're much more aligned there. Now it's more like the outside pressures, right? And so I think when you think about the Malcolm X and you think about Martin Luther King, you think about Harry Belafonte and, you know, some of the conversations that I know that you've had with him and things that he's shared, like so much of that then was outside pressures, you know, the racism, the infighting, all those kinds of things. And so when we come back in our next episode, we'll spend some time like really diving into some of the moments that have been the most difficult to be married to this movement, you know, married in the sense that you are intimately connected and committed to this movement, and married in the literal sense of we are married in the midst of this movement. And and so we'll highlight some of the more difficult points and how we've come through it.
Absolutely. We'll be back for our next episode, episode number 3 of Married to the Movement.
Married to the Movement is brought to you by the North Star. We're so grateful to our members who make this and all the North Star content possible. Members of the North Star will always have access to this content first. So if you're not a member, you can head over to thenorthstar.com, click join now, and access this podcast, as well as a daily column from Sean King, show notes from The Breakdown, and other news for as little as $5 monthly. We super appreciate your support. Shout out to our senior producer, Willis, our podcasting director, Lysandra, and our creative director, Tone, for their work on today's episode. New episode live next week.